Look, the worst part about business travel is worrying about my wife and kids at home alone. My family's safety is my responsibility. That's why I started researching home security. I called the big alarm companies, checked online, even looked at doing it myself. But the best technology for the best price came from Vivint. They even won the Consumer's Digest Best Buy Award. Yes, Vivint gives me a complete security system, but it does even more. Vivint's video technology is unreal. I can see what's going on in my home right from my smartphone, tablet, or computer. I can even lock the doors remotely if my kids forget. Best yet, I got Vivint's no equipment costs and free install deal. $1,300 worth of camera and security equipment at no charge. Vivint was the easy choice for my family's safety.
Take control of your family's safety with Vivint. Order now for up to $1,500 in security equipment at no charge. Just pay as little as $99 for activation. Plus, call now and installation is free. Call 877-205-0849. 877-205-0849. 877-205-0849. Restrictions apply. 48 or 60-month agreement at minimum. $49.99 per month required. Not available in Louisiana. See Vivint.com for license numbers.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Chuck Moore Speaks, your host, Chuck Morse, Monday through Friday, noon to 2 p.m. I'd like to welcome aboard our affiliate stations, of course, Blog Talk Radio, and, of course, Cyber Station USA Radio Network, our chief station, and WWPR-AM in Tampa Bay, Florida, KSKQ-FM in Ashland, Oregon. And, of course, if you want Stitches, which is a download and app that's free, check out the Cyber Station USA Radio Network site, and you can download this program on your Android phone and on other items around the world. So check that out. You're welcome to join the program, 347-327-9849. That number again is 347-327-9849. My guest this segment is Ed Qualls. He is the author of Community Capitalism, Pulling Capitalism Back from Its Own Abyss. Ed, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Ed, basically you bring up issues that affect the economy and are certainly affecting local business and regional business. The main issue you are focusing on here is the effect that outsourcing has had on local business. Can you elaborate on that, please?
The problem that outsourcing has on communities actually comes from two different areas. The main one that we see within our neighborhoods, of course, is the fact that it inevitably produces layoffs, because outsourcing is a replacement for the in-house skills and activities that people have been doing, but that management suddenly decides they can have done more cheaply elsewhere.
Right.
This immediately makes local employees redundant and will inevitably bring on layoffs unless you have an extremely talented management team, which unfortunately in the United States is extremely rare.
Now, Ed, what you're talking about is, in a sense, a classic argument between the free traders and those who are more protectionist-oriented when it comes to American services and industries. And the argument made by the free traders, which is that it's appropriate to lower the borders and allow business to do anything it wants internationally, is that ultimately they claim that it means the cost of goods and services inside the United States for the consumer are cheaper. In other words, if a business outsources its activity overseas, whether it be phone, telecommunication, whatever it is that they're doing, or whether it be through free trade, basically export-import, then the cost of the doing business is less, which means that they can offer the service for less to consumers.
Right. This is an aspect of something that in the book I call MBA capitalism or spreadsheet capitalism. If you remember back in the early days of business computers, say the 60s or 70s, there was a truism which ran along the lines of nobody got fired for buying IBM equipment, which was by and large true. The situation we're in now is that everyone goes to the spreadsheet and they plug the numbers in and they say, oh, well, if we outsource this, we can save this much money. Okay. The fact that they've got it on the spreadsheet means that they have something to go to, and it's essentially their way of covering themselves in management. It hides one aspect, one huge limitation of spreadsheets, and that is there is no spreadsheet formula for goodwill.
Right.
So if you take something overseas, there are several cascading effects that happen that will never show up on the spreadsheet and will rarely be talked about in any business meeting. One, it starts with the fact that outsourcing inevitably, irremediably devastates employee morale. The situation that they end up in is they have the same managers when they're left in the company, and other people have been laid off because of outsourcing. Well, what's going to make those people want to follow that manager's directions when he effectively just shot their neighbor? So it starts tearing down the basic functionality and the vitality of the business. Now, going beyond that, it gets dangerous because there are several businesses in the United States that have actually shipped their core technology out of the United States.
Sure.
Which means it could even be
a national security issue.
It could very well be. The problem is it leaves the area, the group within the United States with no core. And when they're left without that core, the company itself starts losing its innovative drive. Products fall behind, its grip on the market starts to slide. The
Either
problem.
That or they ship it overseas,
right.
And then they import it back. But Ed, you know, I see this as being an even more profound and systemic matter. And by the way, I am with you on this, and I can speak to this personally. In that, I think that what you were talking about here with outsourcing and spreadsheets really is the effect of computers and the internet and the personal computer on the economy. And I think that when the personal computer became prevalent, and today it's as prevalent as someone having a telephone was maybe in the 1940s and 50s, it resulted in a huge dislocation in certain businesses because things could be done suddenly for free, and things could be done all over the world. And I can speak to this because, frankly, I lost my own business in 2005 because of the internet, because people who were hiring me to do a low-tech job nationally, that involving printing and advertising, they found that they could do it for very low cost, if not for free, by developing email databases and sending out the same thing through email. So, and I know that I'm not the only one. It also affected the music business. It affected the publishing business. A lot of publishers went under. It affected the advertising business. And it affected other businesses. So I think what we have here is a natural development, and you know that essentially means this new technology, which can offer all of these fantastic things for very little, if not free, are putting a lot of people out of business. The question is, are they then turning around and creating new areas of endeavor where we can start to get back into other aspects of business?
By and large, no.
Okay.
But
then what do we do? It's kind of like the argument of, I mean, this is a complex question. For example, when the automobile was invented in the early part of the 20th century, it put the horse and buggy industry out of business. And in Massachusetts, there were communities. I'm right here in Boston. that, especially up in Merrimack Valley, the community of Amesbury, that their big business was horse and buggy, and they went to the state and they said, you know, we want you to subsidize us because we're going out of business here. No one needs our products anymore. And the state did not, and that community went into a depression that it's still in. If you
right.
go up there, you still see boarded up factories. And I guess that, but at the same time, the automobile created a whole new area of work, and it created highways, and it created all kinds of industries that are, you know, that are sort of subsidiary to it.
Right. In that case, it's really a situation where management and ownership of businesses get locked into a certain product mix and don't move quickly enough to reestablish, to do reanalysis of their situation and to move their businesses towards the change in the market.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's nothing that the government can do about that. It really has to come from business. Now, the biggest problem with outsourcing overseas is something that American business, in fact, the American community at large, is horribly deficient at. And this is understanding the differences between the cultures. When a company that I know of had a, I have this in the book, and I stated it in a fairy tale format so that it would be not only humorous but memorable. When they had to have a product redone, and it was a web product, when they had to have it redone, they decided to go to someplace overseas, to the Magic Forest,
mm-hmm.
and have it done over there because they got all this great literature from someone over there. Said, yeah, we'll do it for, you know, a little money, and we'll do everything real fast, and we'll get it back to you. So management was very happy. Of course, they alienated everyone who had worked on that product in the first place because they weren't brought into it. Well, a few months later, after this celebration in the management circle, oh, we're getting this great deal and we're getting our product done, and the product came back from overseas and they brought it up and it looked fine, and then they tried to run it and there was nothing back there.
Sure.
The problem was the people overseas did not understand the business purpose of the product. In their culture, they did not have the economic history, the economic background to understand what the product was supposed to do. And so that company ended up having to train the people internally who were already mad to do it in a different technology and do it all from scratch. So what the company ended up with, and of course this is something else that, you know, never shows up on a spreadsheet or on a bullet list in a presentation, is they not only had the problem of paying the first contract, because it was overseas, they really had no remedy. It was not sufficiently costly enough for them to pursue damages, so they just had to swallow the cost. Well, now they've got an angry bunch of rank and file. They've got a product that doesn't work, that they're having to wait to retrain the people to get them to redo it. Now, how much, and, you know, it doesn't take a degree in cost accounting to see this is not going in the right direction, because you have a product that now is a year late. You have a marketplace that may have moved on. You have customers that are unhappy because it's not there at the time that you told them it would be. In fact, it's taking 2.5 times as long to get there. And none of this is considered because of the failure of American business people, American professionals, to understand that different parts of the world have different cultures. And the other aspect of this is one may see, in particularly in service industries, the misapplication of the concept of economy of scale. They think, well, we've got so many people working here in our phone center, and we can have other people, well, those people over there, they speak English, and they can handle it, and they will do it for so much cheaper, and they'll handle so much more volume. And they move their call centers overseas, and they start losing customers because not only have they been misled about the quality of English that's spoken overseas, they end up with people answering the phone who don't know the product, don't know the culture in which the product is used, don't know the culture in which the product was designed and written, yet the managers get bonuses because, hey, look at the money you saved us.
Right.
Yeah, well, there again, there's a problem with the spreadsheet in that nobody's paying attention to the customers they're losing. Personally, I have turned away from several companies just because of bad service like this.
All right. My guest is Ed Qualls. The book is Community Capitalism, Pulling Capitalism Back from Its Own Abyss. Ed, I guess that in the broad sense, my question is, what do we do? First of all, you know, the situations that you're mentioning, they're true, but there are other situations where, overseas outsourcing works just fine. I mean, certainly Apple doesn't seem to have a problem with it, although, I mean, I have a big ethical problem with their employing slave labor practically in communist China. They're able to do it there, and they're able to offer a product in the United States that's more affordable for average people. I mean, just I could speak to this a little bit in that I'm the author of several books, some of which are self-published, and the company that did my self-publishing, they outsourced the artwork and the cover to a graphics company in communist China, and it came back, and I really loved it. I mean, it looked tremendous. But, you know, of course, it's a hit-and-miss situation. We're talking here about anecdotal situations where it hasn't worked. There are other situations where it has worked. But my question to you is to get to the solution side of this. What is it that you are suggesting as a matter of public policy that be done to ameliorate this issue and to, in a sense, keep American jobs and keep American industry here?
I don't know that there's anything that can be done from a governmental point of view. In fact, I would balk at the imposition of bureaucracy on top of it. The main thing that Americans need to realize is that, yes, the price may be cheaper, but the cost may be higher.
Well, you know, you're asking people who are low-income people who shop at Walmart, who can get clothes for their children at a cheaper price because it's imported from China, than if they do it domestically where it's more expensive because we have a higher labor cost, we have a higher standard of living, and I think that's great. But it's just, it gets into a bit of a class issue. You know, I mean, you've got people who can offer something a lot cheaper because they get it made cheaper, because they don't have to pay the overhead and all of the various benefits that our working people get in this country when they do it overseas. Now, I'm not apologizing for it. I'm just mentioning it as a fact.
Right. The situation we're in is one that has really gone farther than most people know. When you're talking about people going to Walmart,
mm-hmm.
there's really little choice between clothes made overseas and clothes made in the United States. There just aren't any anymore. We're in a situation where there's only one silverware maker left in the United States. There's only one company that makes T-shirts in the United States or socks. That if you can make a wise choice for your neighborhood, for your neighbors, for your community. We're in a situation in which if we were faced with the situation we had thrust on us in December of 19, in fact, anniversary today, the United States could not win World War II if it were thrown in its lap today, because we do not have the industrial strength that we once had to produce the materials of war that we would need to fight such a thing. Because
let me just ask you something here, because, look, I mean, you sound a lot like Pat Buchanan, and whom I've interviewed and who's written a book about this and how to protect American industry and how we're losing most of our industry. It's being taken apart piece by piece and it's sent overseas, especially since the NAFTA agreement and the GATT agreement, which led to the World Trade Organization and kind of this whole international trade movement that's been around really going way back in the history of this country, versus those who support protecting American industry and, you know, the old Whig position, which is high tariffs and maintenance of and government economic protection. The question, though, that I have is that you can't ask someone who is a low-income person to make a choice when the choice is that they're going to have to spend more money on a product. So my question to you is, how can we bring back these industries into the United States in a way that they could be produce the same products at the same price, or they can produce it at a price that's more comparable so that people can afford them?
Avoiding protectionism, the best thing would be to have an investment program in which we concentrate on infrastructure, on encouraging business investment within the United States, and we start pouring money into the educational system that rewards excellence in teaching and excellence in scholastic matters, where we try to recover that educational level that we once had.
And I don't see how that's going to affect the cost of goods and services inside the United States. I mean, you're talking about another stimulus package, expanding the federal deficit and having, you know, taxpayer money poured into various interests. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's a bad thing. I believe in supporting infrastructure development. But, I mean, how is that going to lower the cost of goods and services in the United States so that people inside this country, especially lower income people, can buy something without going broke over it? I mean, this is the dilemma here. I mean, if the government either does, you know, the only way to make a more of an economic parity or a cost parity between products and services overseas and those inside the United States, as far as I can see, is to implement tariffs. That will raise money for the government, and it will raise the cost of the services that are coming into the United States because it will be more expensive for China to import it. But that's going to mean that both American and foreign products are going to cost more to the consumer. So my question is, how do we lower the cost of products for our consumers so that people can then want to buy American products?
The main thing is to try to find ways to raise the standard of living.
Yes.
And
well, right now
you do
now
that
getting,
by bringing,
getting,
you do that
do
by bringing
raise,
jobs back.
Okay. Bringing jobs back. I mean, we have, you know, are you going to tell Apple Computer that they have to bring their infrastructure? I mean, they make most of their products apparently in China and Indonesia. Now, I think that it was the late Steve Jobs who actually had a meeting at the White House with President Obama, and the president asked him flat out, "What can we do to bring these jobs back? I mean, how can we get you to take your infrastructure back to the United States?" And Jobs responded by saying, "We can't. It's not going to happen. It's too expensive to produce these things inside the United States." So how can we do it?
Well, one thing to ask is, why do they say it's more expensive? What are they feeding this expense difference into?
Well, it's more expensive, frankly, because labor is more expensive here. And also, the taxes are higher here. I mean, there's corporate taxes, there's capital gains. I mean, there's the whole cost of doing business inside the United States is higher than doing it outside the United States. It's that simple. And I'm not saying that we should lower those things. I admire our interest, you know, what we have. We worked hard to bring labor up to the point where it is. But the problem is that a laborer inside the United States doing the comparable work of someone in Indonesia or in a third world country is much greater, and that cost is going to be passed on to the consumer.
Then the answer may be not to compete in comparable work.
How do you mean? I mean,
if you cannot compete in ditch digging, aim higher. And in, the only way we can do that is to bring education back.
I think you're on to something with that, Ed. But what you're basically doing is you're turning your back on the entire sort of low-tech industrial sector. And you're saying that untrained, you know, people who don't have college degrees, people who are not, who are doing manual labor, they're not going to compete, so we might as well forget it. We should just, you know, let that go overseas and focus on developing a more vigorous professional class, people who are educated, people who can run things here. And I'm not saying that's a bad idea, but that does seem to be what you're saying.
No, it's a case of optimizing the situation industrially to where those people can find jobs and find them at equitable prices, but produce the situation in which, through technology or whatever means, they are still cost-effective over people outside. And the other point is that when Apple talks about, you know, it's too expensive to make things here, that's purely a spreadsheet concept. Frankly, they have stockholders and a speculator market that they have to answer to. They're not answering to the fact that the decisions they may be making may actually be hindering the company as a long-term ongoing enterprise. That what they're doing is they are so concentrating on the present, the quarter, what's the stock doing this moment, that they miss the fact that companies must be, to be true to their investors, they must be ongoing long-term endeavors.
Okay, and, I mean, I'm not sure what you're getting at there, but I think that what they're looking at besides the spreadsheet is the bottom line. I mean, in order for them to create an iPhone, you know, it costs X number of dollars, and then they mark it up to make a profit, and they're taking a look at the cheapest way to do it. But, okay, my guest is Ed Qualls. The book is Community Capitalism, Pulling Capitalism Back from Its Own Abyss. And, Ed, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be back. Please stick with me if you don't mind. I'd like to continue the conversation. You're listening to Chuck Morse Speaks. This is your host, Chuck Morse. Please stay tuned. Is the number. We are back. 347-327-9849. You're welcome to join the conversation. Ed Qualls is my guest. He's the author of Community Capitalism, Pulling Capitalism Back from Its Own Abyss. The website is www.edwardqualls.com. Ed, you asked the question, and by the way, that noise you hear in the background, they're not coming from me. So, how does the rise in foreign economies affect the United States? Ed?
Yeah. The rise in foreign economies?
Yes.
It affects us in two ways.
Mm-hmm.
One of the comparisons I draw to the current situation in the United States is that with China in the year 1900. China was not ready industrially or economically for what happened. The capitalist countries of the, primarily of the West, but even Japan got in on it, flooded the Chinese market with cheap industrial goods. This destroyed the native industries in China and ultimately reduced the standard of living for the entire nation to the point that once a group formed to try to fight this influx of cheap foreign goods and foreign influences, they didn't have the wherewithal to have a decent standing army, and the armies of the West marched in and were able to force the Chinese government to agree to pay back what I believe now would amount to about $32 billion in reparations. It is a case of whether your economy is ready to absorb and react to foreign goods being brought in, and on the other side, how much you can turn around and create goods that you can give, that you can sell back to them. So it tests your resolve as a receiver nation or as an importer nation, but it also tests your abilities as an exporter. The problem that the United States has faced is that with the overwhelming victory in World War II and the devastation of most, if not all, foreign economies, was that American business found itself in the catbird seat, in which everyone came to the United States for goods and exports were high. Businesses didn't have to worry about things. What set in, though, was what the Japanese had termed that they went into, and that was victory disease. But whereas the Japanese were in military victory disease, the American economy went into economic victory disease, in which American companies mistook the fact that they had no competition for successful competition. And that continues even today with American based companies trying to lock all the competition that might try to raise its head by using things like intellectual property rights to lock down anything and everything that might possibly show up with some sort of legal entanglement so that they can keep people away from their market and avoid competition rather than being involved in successful competition. So the situation really presents itself as to just how much vision corporate direction can have in any one situation.
You know, what you're getting into here actually is again, pretty interesting in terms of it makes the argument for, I think, for protectionism. And you're talking about how China was lost their will to protect their own economy in the 19th century and that foreign products, you know, flooded in, not to mention opium and other things that flooded in as well, which demoralized the Chinese people. And then pretty soon European countries were grabbing up little colonies along the coast. And the Japanese, of course, marched in with a full invasion. And it is an interesting analogy in a sense, although we are already a fully, we're post-industrial. I mean, we have the development. China was pre-industrial at the time. And we are, I think you argue well, that we're being hollowed out in that industries have picked up lock, stock, and barrel and moved overseas. They've moved to Mexico, the districts along the border there, and that this has been a policy, a deliberate policy, that's been promoted by successive administrations in this country. Probably, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt sort of started it with the bilateral trade agreements, And Kennedy really, made it much quicker with the Kennedy round in 1963, and it's continued ever since, resulting in the NAFTA and GATT agreement, which basically knocked down all protection policies in North America and around the world, and it transferred the ability of Congress to regulate trade to the World Trade Organization. Now we have President Obama, and it's become something that people view as good, running for office and talking about the great accomplishment of signing three new free trade agreements with South Korea, Taiwan, and Colombia. In other words, that we're going to have products now because of those free trade agreements, assuming that they're ratified, and they probably will be, that it will be flooding in from those three countries inside the United States. So the general, it's an interesting sort of, conundrum. It's sort of an interesting paradox between the sort of the liberal championing of free trade and yet the realities of it as they are hurting American industry, American capital, American infrastructure.
Right. It's an interesting parody, if not irony, that what appears to be a liberal point of view is actually one that conservative business interests have been vocal at saying was needed for quite a while. The removal of any limitations on business methods is something that comes from the right, and the reduction of or abolition of these barriers is actually something that tends to come from the left. So what's a frugal person in the middle supposed to do?
Right, and I don't really agree with you that I think that generally speaking, the right, the so-called right conservatives, have been the champions of protectionism in this country, going all the way back to the days of Alexander Hamilton. I mean, we've always the Republican Party was the protectionist party. I mean, Abraham Lincoln passed two protectionist tariffs, the Morrill tariffs, and you could take a look at the history of that, going all the way back to Eisenhower and Reagan, who also put in tariffs and who tried to protect American industry, and that it's these big multinational corporations that tend, frankly, to be on the liberal side of the political spectrum, at least at their top levels, who have no regard for national borders, who are internationalists, who feel that they can do business anywhere in the world, and just there's some great quotes. Pat Buchanan pulls this down in his book. I don't have it in front of me, but he quotes the head of Boeing as saying that national sovereignty is obsolete, that we need to, look at the fact that the United States is nothing more than one small province in an international economic world now, and that we can do business anywhere in the world that we want. And these guys are not liberals. I mean, these guys are not conservatives by any means. I mean, they tend to be left of center. I mean, this is not a conservative idea. Conservative businesses tend to be smaller. Anyways, you also ask, Ed, you say, how are communist nations using capitalism against the United States?
China in particular is taking advantage of the fact that they can underbid everyone.
Right.
Because of their complete control over the working class, as it were, they can force all sorts of cost cuts and essentially underbid everyone. And this in turn is pulling the guts out of the industrial societies of the rest of the world, us in particular.
Right.
So communism in itself, if used in the way the Chinese have found that it can use it, is actually using, there again, it's using capitalism against itself.
Well, they're using their, first of all, I mean, it's a classic communist idea that they have a command economy where all economic decisions are made by the state, that the corporation is the state. There's no private corporations in China. They're all appendages of the state. And that they do the bidding of the state. I mean, it is, and you're absolutely right, it's very difficult for capitalist countries to compete with that because we don't have that kind of centralized command economy. We have the free market. We respect the right of companies to conduct their affairs privately for the most part. We don't have central planning, as it were.
Right.
And it puts us at a grave disadvantage. But, of course, there's a great history in this country of the biggest corporations, the multinational corporations, going all the way back to the days of Lenin and playing footsie with the communist countries, I mean, because they don't have to compete there. I mean, you can take a look at the history of the Rockefellers, I mean, inside Russia. I mean, they don't want competition. They don't want capitalism. They want to have crony capitalism. They want to have, they don't want to compete, in a sense. They want to use
right.
the government to cut out their competition, and they like governments that don't have to deal with that. They could just go to China, Coca-Cola or Pepsi or any of these companies. They could just go to Russia or China in the days of the Soviets and sign an agreement and have a monopoly there.
Right. And then there was Armand Hammer.
Exactly, who was, the oil company that did, and he wasn't the only one, they all did it. I had an interview with somebody who talks about the fact that the Koch brothers, their father was a big oil man with Stalin. I mean, there was a whole business of that, I mean, back in the early part of the 20th century, and the reason why these big businesses, whether they be oil or whether they be whatever, they can do business in a country where they don't have to worry about competition, and they can cut out their competition domestically in the United States.
Right, and there's the other aspect in that the Chinese government and all communist governments can essentially say exactly what their currency is worth.
Well, that's right. They can artificially inflate or deflate their currencies because it's a state currency. They don't have private banking institutions. They don't have, private bank infrastructure there.
Right.
So what do we do about it, Ed? I mean, how can we survive and how can we thrive in our own custom here, which is a free market custom where you have competition and independent business people getting involved in business in their own way and doing business without the government coming in and starting to centrally plan? How can we continue with that and compete with these gargantuan, colossal, centrally planned economies? And it's not just China either. There are others. I mean, Brazil is coming up the pike now. I mean, there are other countries like that.
Right. The strength of the United States has always been its people, and that's not as big a truism as it might sound. The single biggest thing that I see is that everyone, government, even business, must make an effort to encourage, to do everything they possibly can do to make sure that small businesses have a chance, that people are encouraged to try to follow their dreams, their aspirations, because small business is really the seed from which a strong capitalist economy can grow. And it's the one thing that the communist countries cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
That's our one big plus, is that if we can encourage and foster small business and the growth of small businesses, that's where the future is going to be. That's where most of the employment is already, and it's the driving force. It is the main cylinder in our engine.
Well, Ed, you seem to be describing what I discern as a very conservative view, and it's one that I think. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we can get back to who we are. And allow businesses to thrive inside the United States by having pro-business policies, for example, lowering taxes, lowering certain regulations that allow businesses to function freely, lowering things like corporate taxes and capital gains, and in fact getting local states and communities to invest in helping businesses locate there and do well there and produce things there, and also decentralizing some of our financial and economic areas. You know, like, for example, I mean, I recently had a guest on this program, very liberal guy, by the way, who pointed out that since the late 1930s, all states can only go through Wall Street in New York to invest their pension funds and their, you know, the health insurance and all of their municipal investments. Their bond issuances have to be done through New York, and that this has been in place since 1939, when Franklin Roosevelt set up the Securities and Exchange Commission. The first head of that commission was Joseph P. Kennedy. And that this, before then, and maybe we should get back to this, each state had its own stock exchange. Each state had its own bursar, and that they could invest their pensions locally in companies that did business in the state. And as a result, they kept capital in their state. They were able to monitor it better so that it was more, you know, closely watched, and also that the capital was invested in businesses in the state.
Right.
So, you know, in a sense, it's the idea of localism, getting more, you know, the idea that state banks could come back. For example, North Dakota has the Bank of North Dakota that actually issues currency in North Dakota. And it's a very thriving state, apparently, economically, because they can issue loans in a manner that does not exceed the amount of credit that the state can absorb. And
right.
You have investment. So, you know, I think that the vision, at least what I have, and I've, you know, I've spent time on this interviewing people, is that we need to get back to what we are, which is a free market capitalist country where you have local control, less government, less taxes, a reduction in the size of the public sector, and you let people do what they want to do and create stuff that they want to create. That is what made us what we are. And that is how we can compete with these big communistic systems where they don't have any personal control. And they, you know, our way of life, we want to preserve that. I want to see workers get paid well. I want to see the value of the dollar high. You know, I mean, it's, you know, we don't want to go by way of China where people
right.
are virtually in slavery.
Right. Well, if, when people ask me what I am, to put that in air quotes, I have to tell them I'm a Jacksonian Democrat, with apologies to my Cherokee and Washita and Osage relatives. And the reason for that is Andrew Jackson was vehemently in favor of the little guy.
Yes.
He
and
was
also
everything
Jackson.
About the little guy.
Andrew
and he
Jackson.
Was.
He was. And he, his main, one of his main causes was he got rid of the Second Bank of the United States.
Right, because it was primarily a political organization. It was actually giving money to the campaigns of his rivals, and in that way, the Second Bank of the United States was really in the position of the mega banks nowadays.
Well, no, the Second Bank of the United States was in the position of the Federal Reserve today. I mean, we could get into a very controversial topic, but what they do is they lend money to the federal government so that it can expand its public sector, and then they sell the bonds and the debts on Wall Street. I mean, when we make reference to Wall Street, that's a big part of it. And that basically every time a dollar is created in this country, it's a debt instrument. We're paying. We're not having – I mean, Jackson wanted to have money created directly by the state banks under federal auspices with backed by gold and – you know, a very set ratio of fractional banking, as opposed to this big private bank that operated and had a monopoly. I mean, his speeches on that topic are fantastic. He really laid it out.
The thing about the Federal Reserve and the money supply is something I go into the background of in the book, and that's explaining how money is created in the United States. It applies to almost all governments today that are not still communist. And I explain the nature of money. All money, no matter what token it's tagged to, is a debt instrument. It is essentially an instrument of the a promissory note, if you will. It's a promise by the economy that issues it that there will be goods and or services in exchange for that amount. And it doesn't matter what token, whether it's paper, gold, silver, platinum, or big stone circles that it's attached to, if it doesn't have that aspect of debt or exchange attached to it, it stops being money. And you can see that in that when the Donner Party was stuck in the snow, those pieces of gold and silver they had in their pockets were meaningless because there was nothing to exchange them for. What they needed was food. So the role of the Federal Reserve in that way has actually been stabilizing in that we've had we had no bank panics, no financial crises from the end of the Depression until Ronald Reagan's presidency.
Well, we've had them also with Bush. I mean, what about the AIG and the big bank bailouts of 2008, 2009? I mean, there have been, and look, I'm not against the existence of a Federal Reserve. I think it's necessary to have a board of private bankers, which is what the Federal Reserve is, working under the – it should be – I think it should be more directly, under control of Congress. But the problem –
Really what you're talking about with that is a situation where the hidden the hidden banking system or the shadow banking system took control over too much of the economic situation, and all of a sudden it was forced to the surface. It's an area that the Federal Reserve has no control over, and that's the derivatives, the financial instruments that are traded amongst the big international banks.
Right.
Now, that's exactly where our bailout money from 2008 went, was up into that hidden economy between the banks, and it never showed up in circulation. There was
credit. Those big international banking houses are members of the Federal Reserve Board, and the business of the derivatives, which I had people on the show before that even that happened, warning about that. I mean, it happened because of the deregulation of the industry. I mean, they got rid of bills that were put in place by Franklin Roosevelt and by Hoover that was supposed to separate the regular bank from these big private banking houses that are international, and they were done away with during the Clinton administration.
During the Reagan administration.
No, it was Clinton. It was actually the head of the Federal Reserve at the time, that being Alan Greenspan and Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and the rest of those guys, who are all very, radical, I mean, in my opinion, Ayn Rand-oriented, total libertarian government, very stringent, complete free market types. They deregulated much of the industry. And this was during the Clinton years, and that's what led to a sort of a, things went wild after that. You know, you had the Federal Reserve lower the interest rates, lower the back window to groups like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all part of social policy. And you ended up with an expansion of credit that was unprecedented in world history, and the whole thing crashed. But anyways, that's a big subject.
Yeah, the separation of the banks from stock handling and other gaming procedures actually was something that happened during the Reagan administration. And
you're not. I'm sorry, but you're not correct. It was they got rid of the I forget the name of the bill right now off the top of my head, but it was the Glass-Steagall, which happened during the Clinton administration, not Reagan. That was in 1996, I think. And it basically did what you're describing. It allowed the banks, the banks to take their reserves and then put it into risky investments. Something that, look, maybe on this area, I actually tend to be a bit more liberal in that I think that the government has to be involved in very vigorous management of financial interactions. You know, you could take a look, for example, at how Germany does it. They do a very good job in several other European countries. I think Switzerland and the Netherlands. They do not allow banks to invest in certain things. They have a very tight regulation. They do not allow such, you know, risky investment because they understand that people's money and that the nation's money, that these sorts of investments are complicated and risky. So they, you know, people can't know what's happening with their investments. So they have a very high standard of transparency. You have to, you know, the banks have to issue a monthly report saying exactly what they're investing in. There's a lot of oversight. And we had that structure. We had part of it during the, it was put in place during the Roosevelt years, and they got rid of it. It eroded gradually. I mean, there were even, for example, in this country, we used to have usury laws. Banks could not lend money over 6%. I mean, it goes back to the days of the colonies. And those laws were gradually eroded by banking interests to the point where they don't exist anymore. Banks can now charge up to 30% interest if they want.
Yeah.
I think you and I are on the same side on this one, Ed. I mean,
yeah,
in terms of government being involved in regulating financial transactions, you know, and keeping oversight, you know, both state and federal governments to protect
right.
people's money, to protect the nation's money, so that these sorts of things don't happen.
Right. It's a case where essentially what I put forth is a suggestion that the Glass-Steagall Act be brought back in its entirety because you just can't trust a lot of people put in this situation to act in the best interest of the public. Speaking of usury laws, in Texas for the longest time, a bank could only be owned by a single individual or a partnership. And this was because the ranchers and farmers wanted to know the people that they were dealing with directly. They wanted a personal relationship with the bankers.
Yeah, I think
and
that's a reasonable idea. I mean, for that
state. At the same time, to form a corporation took an act of the state legislature. So there was a very strong impetus within Texas against faceless corporate business behavior.
And I think that's a good thing. I mean, Texas has one of the best economies in the country right now. I mean, I don't know if they have those same laws in place, but they have a tradition of maintaining, you know, a certain amount of oversight in that way. I mean, those are state matters. I think that different states have different situations.
Right. The thing about what I'm saying being tariff-oriented or protectionist-oriented, my standpoint is not formally in favor of, or I should say in favor of, formal tariffs. It's the reinvigoration of the American spirit.
Mm-hmm. And
I know that's such a wide topic. It's formless unless you start at the point of what I bring up in the book about education, about the need for a national established language as the thing that is the current language of commerce and business, at the same time that encouragement is given to the learning and maintenance of other languages. The fact is, the United States is going to have to become a really huge Switzerland if we're going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to learn to accept the fact that there are other cultures in the world, and yes, many of them have value, not just economic, but things that we can learn from. Now, the favorite whipping boy of the conservatives because of entitlement, if you can't see my air quotes, is Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
although Sweden
yes,
has moved toward free market in recent decades,
it's there are a lot of entitlement programs in Sweden. But the thing that is never mentioned by these people is the fact that in Sweden businesses don't pay income taxes. They don't pay capital gains taxes. They don't pay taxes to the national government.
Right.
They may pay local street access taxes or little real estate taxes.
And their executives pay income tax. It's just that they don't have corporate tax.
Right. So what has happened is that the government of Sweden is owned by the people because the people pay for it directly.
And the program, it's been a very interesting talk. We should do it again. Let people know how they can get your book.
They can go to my personal website, www.edwardquals.com. That's E-D-U-A-R-D. Or you can go to www.vexedviking.com, a direct link to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's available on Amazon.
Send me a note. Maybe I'd like to have you back sometime. Maybe send me your book, and it's been very, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ed Qualls, we shall return Monday at the usual time, noon Eastern Standard Time. This is Chuck Moore, source of Chuck Moore Speaks. I want to thank everyone for listening. Have a good afternoon, everybody.